Good evening, everybody, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Tonight's on assignment with National Geographic. I am Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and co-chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Forum. Tonight, we are happy to welcome to the Commonwealth Club as our moderator and as an organizer of our program tonight, Edwin Dobb. Edwin was a former editor-in-chief of the Sciences magazine, former contributing editor of Harper's, and is now writing for the National Geographic. Edwin will introduce you to our panel members tonight. And it's my pleasure to introduce him and welcome him as he introduces our distinguished panel. Edwin?
Thank you, Ann, and thank all you for coming tonight. I'm going to make this brief. To just set the stage a little bit, National Geographic, as all of you know, is known for its photography. It's primarily a picture magazine. That's why many of us have stacks of past issues at home in the basement or the garage or the closet somewhere, or family members who do. And it's the reason why today we continue to hold on to them. They're just gorgeous to look at. But more and more, the publication has been using top-notch writers as well as top-notch photographers. Consequently, the stories today often are as compelling and enduring as the photographs. This evening, we've assembled three writers who exemplify this shift: Andrew Todhunter, Cynthia Gorney, and Timothy Ferris. Good storytelling, as Cynthia and I constantly remind our students at the Berkeley Journalism School, depends on thorough research and reporting. Thankfully, National Geographic understands this. The magazine still supports in-depth fieldwork trips, enabling writers to immerse themselves in their subject matter. I might add, they also, unlike many other publications, still have the resources to do it. Which all of us are very happy about. There's nothing quite, as a writer, quite like being able to truly engage your subject and be able to immerse yourself in someone else's reality. It gives you a lot more confidence about your storytelling. We've asked the panelists to simply share some of their most memorable fieldwork experiences, and I'm defining fieldwork broadly, from the depths of the sea to faraway stars. So we're going to go one by one and do three different presentations, then we'll open it up to Q&A. Our first panelist, Andrew Todhunter, is the author of three books, including A Meal Observed, which won a Penn USA Literary Award. He has written for many national magazines and has worked on numerous film projects, including productions for Lucasfilm and National Geographic Television. Andrew teaches writing at Stanford University. He's written for both National Geographic Adventure and National Geographic itself, where he's had two cover stories within the past 2 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Something like that.
Yeah. Please welcome Andrew Todhunter.
Thank you, Ed, and thank you, Ann, and thank you all for coming this evening. It's a real pleasure to be here in this wonderful club. This is my first time, my first visit. I hope not my last. As Ed said, it is really wonderful to be able to work with an institution like National Geographic that has the history that it has and does have the capacity to send its photographers and its writers all around the world and to give them the time and the resources to really get the story. We feel very grateful for that. I was thinking of the various things that I've done for them. I've written a few stories for the National Geographic family. One piece for Adventure, which is now no longer with us, unfortunately. I think I may have killed the magazine with the story I wrote. But I wrote about paddling sea kayaks between single malt scotch distilleries in the Hebrides, the Inner Hebrides of Scotland. And I'm not a huge Scotch drinker, but in that context, I think anyone would, you know, would at least sip a little. And so we would paddle between the distilleries and get out of the kayak and go up and have just a teeny little taste and have a little lunch perhaps and get back in the kayaks. And it was truly just a remarkable journey. So I always recommend that to people. But rather than going into too much detail about that trip, I thought that perhaps the most memorable experience that I've had for geographic in terms of things in the field was training in cave diving for a story that I wrote that appeared in the August 2010 issue about Bahamian blue holes. So blue holes are, we could talk for a long time about them, but essentially they are submerged cave systems. Some of them are inland, some of them are offshore. The ones that we dove in were inland. And I've been scuba diving for a long time, but when I was younger, I always swore I would never go cave diving. And yet here I was, I found myself, you know, in the Bahamas on assignment with a bunch of scientists and cave divers and facing the prospect of actually cave diving. And I had, by that point, and still do, fortunately, three children and a wife. And, you know, so I approached this with real trepidation. And I reserved the right all the way to the very end. And my editor, fortunately, was fine with this. I said, you know, look, if I get down there and I get spooked or I don't trust the instructor or any reason at all, I'm not going in that hole. And I'll have to report the old-fashioned way and, you know, just sort of ask them, so what did you see down there? Which I've never liked. I always prefer going with, flailing along after the experts and trying to see what they see down there. And then you talk to them, too. So to really get the story, I had to dive, if I could possibly bear it. So I got down there, and the instructor made me feel very at ease. He's a wonderful guy, very, very calm, so I felt okay. And I looked at the system. I looked at the gear. It was packed with redundancies, you know, so you'd really have to blow it. You'd really have to do a series of stupid things, really stupid things, one after another, to overcome all the redundancy. So I felt, okay, I'll try only to do one or two stupid things, and I will make it back. And I trusted him, so I would be with him. And so in the course of the training, which was extensive, obviously, it went on for about a week, and we did all kinds of different things. And, you know, you progress. You start very close to the entrance, and you go deeper and deeper, and you learn various skills. Of the many skills that we went over, the most exciting, I would say, was what they call the lost line drill. And I'll share that with you. In case any of you are thinking of going cave diving, you'll know what to expect in the training. So one of the things that you have to stay safe in a cave system, at least one that has been explored, is the explorers will lay line. They will affix nylon line from the entrance where your air, you know, ultimate air source is, and then going all the way back. So it's, you know, kind of like a trail of breadcrumbs, nylon breadcrumbs, and you must always be on that line. Now, you don't always have to hold it, but you need to know where it is always, because if you become separated from that line, given how complex and often seemingly repetitive, you know, the terrain is and how easy it is to become disoriented, there's no sun, you know, it's a very, very different environment, and you're hovering there, you know, you think, oh, yeah, that's the passage, you know, that's right, you know, I go around that rocky bit. And so if you lose the line, you're in very, very deep trouble, very deep trouble, even with the redundancies, right? Because you may, in the search for the line, you may go off into some cul-de-sac, and then eventually you run out of air, and this happens, right? And people will eventually, you know, occasionally they'll realize, I better scratch my last words into my scuba tank, and they do so, and then eventually they find them. So, okay, stay on the line. I got that. That was a really good one. And if you do that, and if you watch your air, you know, you don't forget your air, then you will, you feel safer. I was surprised to feel, you feel safer in a cave than I often feel in the open water, where you have currents, you know, and all other kinds of factors. It feels very controlled in a cave. So in order to find the line, if you become separated, they give you this drill where they complicate it as if you didn't, as if you needed it to be complicated. They say, well, let's imagine that you become separated from the line and you now have zero visibility. Because this too happens. There will often be silt, often quite a bit of silt in the, on the cave floors. And if a diver, a beginner like me or someone else, kicks it up accidentally, you can go from very clear, beautiful visibility with this silty bottom to zero. I mean, you'll see a little haze of your light, but it will be zero, this, until that silt settles. So if you panic, right, then you're just going to kick up more silt. And if you flail down a passage or somewhere trying to find the line in an irrational way, then you will burn through your air very quickly. Because if you're panicking, you know how fast you breathe when you're panicking. You can see your gauge, do that. So none of that is acceptable. You can't do any of that. So there you are. You're going to be in a zero visibility, lost line situation. So my instructor, they don't do this on the first day, mind you, very fortunately. My instructor said, this is what we're going to do. You're going to close your eyes and you will not open them. Okay, until the drill is over. And I'm going to take you away from the line in this chamber. Now, not a huge chamber, but, like a third of the room, maybe a little smaller perhaps. And I'm going to take you away from the line, and I'm going to spin you around and disorient you completely, and then I'm going to let you go. And then you're going to find the line. Because this is what happens, right, if you get off the line and you zero out your vis. Now, he had told me previously how you do it. You don't just kind of swim around randomly. You have what's called a little personal reel of line with a hook on it, and you find a feature, say this, a rocky bit on the ground, and you tie the line to it. This is all blind. And then you feel it, and you realize, okay, this horny part is pointing this way, so let's call this up, and that's going to be down. So now I'm going to tie it off, and then letting it go as you swim out carefully, you follow a specific direction. So I might go this way. And you're unreeling here. So then you know your starting point, right? You're not going to get much further away. And then you do this, right? Really as far as you can everywhere, and you hope you hit the line. And what's amazing is how many weird little pockets and things you get into, little weird rocky things, and you bounce off pointy rocks, with your forehead. It's very, very strange. I was struck in the middle of this as I began to do the pattern. I was struck by by the degree to which the lizard brain cannot accept that this is a simulation. It doesn't buy it. And you keep trying to convince yourself, look, Brian is right there. If I really need to open my eyes, I can. I'm not that far from the entrance. This is a drill. But the panic kept coming up to be blind. And I never thought of opening my eyes. I mean, I also knew he was watching. He was creeping around. And I thought he'd fail me or whatever. So, I was not going to open my eyes. But you are blind, and you don't know where you are, and you're weightless. And it was extremely frightening. And so, this panic kept welling up and welling up. So you would get to, in my case, I got to a wall. And he predicted that this would happen. You get down, and I hadn't found the line. I'd gone all the way across what felt like the chamber. And I got to the wall, and there was nothing. And then you're supposed to go back, and you reel in your line, right? And you find your feature. And then you go, okay, I'm going to go the other way. And you do that. And then in this fashion, you're supposed to make spokes. And if you're lucky, right, you will actually find the line. Now, if this happens, as he told me, there's no guarantee, even if you do it this way and even if you stay calm, you may still run out of air before you find the line. And what's probably even more likely, if it takes you a while, is that you'll run out of air before you get to the entrance, because you will burn so much of your precious gas in the search. Yeah. And there are men, far too many stories of divers, that are found, this far away from the entrance. on the line. Mm-hmm. They were on the line. They could see the light, and they just missed it. All right. And so I'm imagining all these things, and thinking, I had promised not to do this, and my wife, and she's going to kill me. You know, I'm not going to come back. And, you know, this is, what am I doing? This is insane. I'm not going to find the line. I can't find it. And then you panic again, you know, and then you calm down again. And so it took me what felt like 4.5 hours to find the line, you know, doing these, this spoking pattern. And I was sure. I said, I've gone throughout the whole chamber. It is not here. And finally, you know, I was, it was about 11 minutes total. Finally, boom, there's this little pressure, you know, on the upswinging hand. And I felt it. And it, I mean, the joy and the relief of finding that line, I was just exquisite. So we got out, and we're breaking down gear, and Brian said, well, you know, it's funny, there was a Canadian guy who had been diving a long time, and he came down, and he was really gung-ho about all this, and we started the training, he loved it, he did great, he was very calm, and we did all this, it was a piece of cake, and then we get into the lost line drill, and a couple minutes in, he went absolutely bananas. He just went berserk in the cave. And he let go of the reel, and he went up to the top of the cave, and he began to claw wildly at the rock roof of the cave as if he could claw his way out. And it took quite a while for Brian just to calm him down and say, look, you know, and he took him out. And they got out, and the guy didn't say anything. He just went into the truck and sat there, and he said, I'm going to the airport. And Brian took him to the airport, and he never came back, and he never asked for a refund, and he never. And I said to Brian, well, I'm really glad you didn't tell me that little anecdote when we were gearing up for this. But anyway, so that's a moment. Fortunately, all was well. The diving was beautiful. And it was well worth it.
So you went down to like 130 feet or something eventually?
Later, yeah, with the team. Yeah. Yeah.
So. Hope you got some hazard pay for that.
In fact, I did.
I've asked for it.
In fact, I did. Which was nice.
Hell yeah. Terrific. So. Okay. Our second panelist is Cynthia Gorney, my colleague at the Journalism School.
I have a list, I think, somewhere of things I will never do, no matter how much anybody offers to pay me, and that just went right on that list. When you got to the part about even thinking about the cave underwater, I was already hyperventilating. With the line drill, no, not a chance. The thing that I love most about the Geographic is like a giant magnification of what I love most about being a reporter generally, as my students know, which is that you get hurled into these things that you know nothing about. Some of us, like Tim, have genuine expertise in the fields that they almost always write about. Others of us love most the chance to just go and be told that you have to learn all about something and try to convey its complexity. And the thing that I love most about the Geographic, because that's the thing that I most enjoy doing, is figuring out the ways in which things are complicated, because I believe that the world is a complicated place. And the thing I love most about the Geographic is that, as has been said, they will throw just absurd amounts of money at the simple act of finding stuff out, which is something that hardly anybody does anymore. They're a foundation. They're not without financial resources. I just went to a meeting of writers there, and we learned it's not bad news at all. They're actually breaking even now, interestingly, or making money and gaining circulation again because they're moving on to the iPad. So part of what we have to think about, and it's kind of fun, is how our writing can benefit from the iPad without being instructed to blog from caves, for example, which has occurred to some people, and the rest of us are like, no, you really don't want us doing that. But the single most complicated story, for sure, I think, that I was sent to work on was a piece that took quite a long time to put together that ran last year on child marriage. And the story, the most memorable single night out of all that very memorable experience occurred in North India. This story began with me actually saying no to something, because the photographer, who's an amazing woman named Stephanie Sinclair, who is nothing but guts, Actually won a number of big deal awards this year for the work on this piece, this Child Bride's piece, last year. Called me before we knew each other. She had a reputation as a really tough cookie. I'd never met her. And our first conversation, she says, so, you know, you're going to have to go to Afghanistan. And I said, no. That's, you know, like, let me think about it. No. She said, no, I've done images in Afghanistan. You're going to have to go to Afghanistan for this piece. And I said, you're going to have to find another writer, Madir, because I'm not going to Afghanistan. This was in 2009. This is the only time in my life that I have ever just flat out turned down an assignment because of the physical safety factor. And I have to say that I hung up the phone and then had a conniption because it's not what I do. It wasn't that difficult. This is not a war story that had to be set in Afghanistan. This is an international problem for which, I mean, Afghanistan is one small piece of the child bride issue. There were many, many other places that we could report from. I sent a note to a friend of mine who I knew, who was a Washington Post correspondent who had just come back from Iraq and Afghanistan, and I said, you're one of the only people in the world who are going to understand why this felt weird to me. I have kids. I have a husband. Same deal, right? Except some of us actually become logical when confronted with that. Just teasing. And my friend sent me simultaneously an email and two texts saying, do not go, and in case you misunderstand me in any way, do not go. So that it turned out that he was one of the few reporters who knew that David Lodge was his name, right? Mm-hmm. The New York Times reporter David Rode was being held captive at that time by the Taliban, and the New York Times was keeping it secret, and there were a few people there who knew, but they were actually taking down reporters as part of the war effort. So once we got that cleared up, we figured out that there were lots of other places that we could go. We decided to do the primary field reporting. Stephanie had been in four countries by this time, but the primary field reporting we were going to do was in North India and in Yemen. Yemen was, I hasten to say, a very different place politically and security-wise in 2009 than it is today. And, in fact, my Yemen experience was marvelous and memorable. But when I went to India, there were a bunch of things about this experience that were fabulous and fascinating and kind of like, and I'm serious about this, any one of you being thrown into that situation. I do not speak Hindi. I had never been to India before. I'm not accustomed to working with a translator because normally I work in Latin America and I speak Spanish, and it's a whole different experience when you have somebody who's with you who has to do your interpretation for you. I didn't know anything about this, the subject of child marriage, and in fact, when my editor called me to let me know that this was going to be my topic, my initial reaction was, what's complicated about this? These people should all be shot. End of story. She said, no, it's actually pretty complicated. We ended up, finally, Stephanie turned out to be an astonishing person to work with in terms of her tenacity. And the moment that was the most memorable to me in terms of all the layers of understanding that were required for this subject, and I venture to say for just about any subject that any of us here try to take on for the Geographic, took place at an overnight midnight wedding in which the brides were three young girls, two young teenagers, and a five-year-old, which we hadn't known until we got there. The marriage had been arranged by this five-year-old's grandfather, who was basically her caretaker because her own father was a drunk. And the thing that was the most fascinating to me was how very, very complicated by that time I understood that this whole experience was. Thinking about it from afar, your first reaction is, oh, my God, grab the kid and run away. This is horrible. Just make it stop. But having spent enough time on this subject by now, watching this child be lifted gently from her nap so that she could go be married ceremonially in a Hindu ceremony to the 8-year-old boy who was to be her husband, made me understand the level of protection and fear and complication and how it is that parents could be so caught up in a culture that they genuinely believe that they're protecting this child, joining her to another family that will be the right kind of family for her, and sending her into a life that will bring her some kind of satisfaction and company, rather than into a life of permanent poverty where she might be attacked by another young man, lose her virginity, be ineligible for marriage, and essentially be removed forever from her community. Obviously, the subject is incredibly complicated and long, but the main thing I do remember most vividly about that night was at about 2 o'clock in the morning, watching this child get lifted, put onto her uncle's shoulder, and carried to the fire where the ceremony could take place, and feeling as I watched it, as I think we all should in National Geographic context, incredibly humble, incredibly dumb, grateful for the chance to learn how complicated this was, and furious and sad all at the same time. So that's my Nat Geo story. And the picture that I keep on my wall when I'm writing now is a picture of this little girl just with her big brown eyes looking up at us. And the thing that I try to carry in everything else that I do for the magazine is that same level of sort of ignorance and gratitude and curiosity all at the same time.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program on assignment with National Geographic, with moderator Ed Dobb and panelists Cynthia Corney, who you just heard from, Andrew Todhunter, and Timothy Ferris.
Okay. Just to finish up, I highly recommend you reading that story. It's quite moving, as you can imagine. And Cynthia has a really fine touch, an ability to tease out the complexities and use her own naivete and humor and sense of irony and even a little appetite for the kind of the surrealism of the moment to give you a feel for the way other people live in a non-judgmental way. Not that you won't come away from it with some pretty strong feelings. Our third panelist is Timothy Ferris, called the most popular science writing in the English language by the Christian Science Monitor. Timothy is the author of a dozen books and more than 200 articles and essays. His three documentary films about astronomy and cosmology have been seen by over 20 million viewers. He's a Pulitzer and National Book Award nominee. He's also an emeritus professor at the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. There's a little bit of a conspiracy going on here. His cover story in the recent issue of National Geographic includes this, I'm assuming, Timothy, partly tongue-in-cheek footnote. It says, Timothy Ferris has been covering the universe for more than 40 years. You can't get any broader than that.
The one sentence in the piece I didn't write.
Please welcome Timothy Ferris.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm delighted to be back at the Commonwealth Club, a remarkable institution. The sort of things I cover are enormous and very hot and very cold and would be scary if they weren't thousands to millions of light years away. So I don't have as adventurous stories as my colleagues do, but I thought I would tell you a little bit of how I first became impressed by the National Geographic and first began to think of how wonderful it would be if there ever were a time when I could become a writer and write for this unique magazine. I was a teenager, and I was in Jamaica on a ship called the Sea Diver, Ed Link. I was doing undersea archaeology on the sunken city of Port Royal, Jamaica, right across Kingston Harbor. There was this city reputed to be the most sinful in the Western Hemisphere that was peopled primarily by pirates. And it was also built on ballast. In the colonial days, ships would come over from Europe, sailing vessels, with their holds full of brick ballast, because the Europeans weren't sending all that much to the New World. They were taking things out of it. And the ballast was simply dumped in the ocean on the far furthest part of the harbor until it formed a kind of a spit. And this riotous, lawless, pirate-ridden city had grown up on this fill. And one day in 1692, an earthquake struck, and the entire city instantly slid into the harbor. So it was a very interesting dive. The city had accordion, you know, what had been rooms had often been turned into just two walls pressed together and with debris in it. And Ed and his divers were excavating relics from the wreckage using what was then a relatively new technology. Today we describe it as rather crude, but it consisted of manipulating, I guess, about a 10-inch in diameter vacuum pipe that was just drawing in water, and it had a screen across the front. You would hold this pipe, and as you described, actually, you're surrounded by silt. You typically couldn't see anything. And you'd put your hand in front of the screen and grab anything substantial that showed up. And in this fashion, some quite interesting things have been found, including sealed bottles of wine and things you wouldn't have thought would survive. And I had not been there long when a man pulled up in a white D-model Jaguar Roadster, the stunningly beautiful young woman in the passenger seat, and jumped out and got on board and proceeded to start taking pictures. And he was the now legendary Louis Martin, the photographer who had persuaded National Geographic to stop shooting with big, heavy plates. It used to be 200 pounds minimum that you had to carry as a photographer on assignment for National Geographic. And instead to shoot with Leicas using the then-new Kodachrome film, which is almost grainless and had these rich colors. And years later would become a subject of a Paul Simon ode. And I observed this guy. I didn't know much about him initially. I subsequently learned more. Louis, in the evenings, wore bespoke tailored London suits with cufflinks made from pieces of iron from spikes taken from the wreckage of the HMS Bounty, Captain Bligh's ship, which wreck he had himself discovered by persuading his editors at the National Geographic to fund his dive in waters so dangerous that few had ever tried to find this wreck. He had found it and had the cufflinks to prove it. He had suffered the bends diving in a well in Yucatan, which was reputed to have the bones of many a young virgin from the old days at the bottom of it, and had to be flown, I think, to Florida. He described this as a sort of minor inconvenience, the way people today would talk about. He described hours with the bends going to the nearest compression chamber hundreds of miles away, the way people today talk about their flight being canceled at O'Hare. He discovered a species of orchid which was named for him. He lived in a house overlooking the Potomac that he had had designed for him by Frank Lloyd Wright. And what most impressed me as a teenager was that he was constantly drowning cameras. This would happen a lot in those days with undersea work. And periodically, every so often, a case, a wooden crate would appear, wanting, I gather, a chain of them that were constantly being dispatched. It was full of Nikons and lenses. And I thought, well, this is a marvelous way to make a living. I recently looked at Louis' photographs. Many of them are online now. And Many of them look a little posed by modern standards, you know, women doing the laundry in the stream or combing silk. Although I notice that they tend to be astonishingly beautiful women in every case. So it represented the country in a positive way, but also said something about Louis's working methods, which were too... He was selective in his recruitment of subjects for his photographs. And I think it was that experience that turned me into a photographer. I started out as a photographer. It's just this amazing things that could be done with this magazine that no one could seem to throw out. You know, it was just too beautiful an object to do away with. So I'm trying to think if I have anything to compete with your stories. I'll just tell a joke that's in the context of something that happened. I was in Chile doing an astronomy piece with the photographer Douglas Kirkland. And Douglas and I had arrived and were driving up the coast to the remote location of these observatories, a coast that looks very much the way California must have looked a century or so ago. And we discovered that neither of us speak Spanish. So we were saying, oh, that's a bit awkward, particularly because this was during the Pinochet regime and there were military checkpoints. We expected to encounter at least one, which was all we did encounter on this long highway. And I've always had trouble with languages, and so I told Doug a joke that expressed my sense of anxiety about the problem I have, being that even if you learn to say a few things and then you say them successfully, a torrent of verbiage comes back at you, and then you're at a loss. I can always speak better than I can hear, I suppose. And the old joke was that a man from some remote spot, you know, far away a stand, is in... A diner in Chicago, and he having lunch, and he's reading a paper sent to him in his native farawayistan language, and another man comes over and says to him in his native language, are you from farawayistan? And I said, well, yes, I am. Yes, I saw your newspaper. Can you please help me? I've been here in Chicago for 2 months. I'm on some sort of job assignment, and I know no English. And I've eaten every single meal at this diner, and every single meal has been bacon and eggs, because the only thing I know how to say in English is bacon and eggs. Can you please tell me how to order something else? And his countryman says, well, of course, you know, what would you like, perhaps a nice beefsteak or something? And I say, that would be wonderful. So okay, you say, I'll have a steak. And they rehearse it. The countryman, having finished his lunch, folds up his newspaper and leaves. The other man goes back to his booth. The waitress comes over, says, what'll it be? And he says, I'll have a steak. And she says, wonderful. How would you like it? Rare? Medium? Well done? Bacon and eggs. So I just finished telling Doug this story. He was, I think I was driving. He was in the passenger seat. When ahead was a military checkpoint. It was exactly the sort of one that you don't want to run into. Just two people visible, a corpulent sergeant, the safety off, presumably day and night on his assault rifle, which he poked in the open window and let loose a torrent of Spanish that neither of us understood. And I was literally at a loss for words, and Doug leaned over and, in a commanding tone, shouted at him, bacon and eggs. To my astonishment, the man stepped back and yelled at the man operating the gate. The gate went up. We drove on. To this day, I don't know what he thought we had said. I should also just mention in closing that the National Geographic has one of the best cartography shops in the world, and periodically has applied its talents to cosmology and the local universe and the deeper universe. And when I was young, those were great guides to me. They taught me that it's all nature. You know, nature's not just here, and it's most of nature, 99.54 more nines, percent of nature, is elsewhere than on the earth. And I endeavored to try to learn more about it, and I've been doing that ever since.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program on assignment with National Geographic with moderator Ed Dobb, panelists Cynthia Gorney, Andrew Todd-Hunter, and Timothy Ferris. We've come to that part of our program where we have our audience questions, and Bill Grant is here to help with those. I'm going to start out. I get to have the first question. And I'm going to ask each of you, what was your favorite story? So do you want to take a minute to think? Or if you want to name two, just to be politically correct, that would be fine. So, Ed, what was your favorite story?
I think it's the last one I did, which hasn't appeared yet. And it's a, briefly, it's set in a remote part of Manitoba. It's a forest conservation piece. But it's also a cultural survival piece. It's looking at the conservation of a chunk of the boreal through the experience of a small First Nation village in this very remote area. And I was quite moved by what was going on there because I saw firsthand the degree to which preserving the land, the traditional territory of this small group, was absolutely essential to healing the damage that had been done to this local culture by, you know, decades of attempts to frankly destroy it, primarily through residential schools where kids were pulled out of their families and out of their villages at age 6 and 7, sent away to Christian schools where they didn't see their parents for 7, 8, 10 years, weren't not allowed to speak the native language, were not allowed to refer to or practice any of their customs, and when they returned home, were completely disconnected from their local village. Not all that different from what happened here in the States, but more recently in the historical experience of Canada, and in fact, there's a truth and reconciliation process going on there now that's really quite extraordinary, where people are getting together and talking about it. So I met people my age who went through that experience. It was like, for me, it was I got pretty close to a reality that I wasn't aware of, and made a big impression.
Andrew? Besides the cave story, which has convinced me I will never go diving.
never get in the sea again.
Right.
Well, I mean, in terms of geographic projects, I think I'll have to stay with that one. Not for that reason, but because of the incredible richness of experience there. I mean, there was a team of scientists from, you know, many, many different disciplines. There were native Bahamians that we were working with. There were divers and explorers. So it was just an extraordinary team of people working together. The story also had a strong conservationist slant because the blue holes are endangered. So there was that piece. I met my first astrobiologist on that story, people who study the possibility of life in the universe, and interestingly, a lot of that work they do by studying the very smallest life here on Earth. They study slime and bacteria mats and other things to determine if these bacteria can live in an anoxic environment, for example, in a blue hole, maybe they could live beneath the frozen crust of Europa. So they study these creatures in that way. So it was a combination of the incredible aesthetic, I mean, the spectacular beauty of the interior of the caves and the almost mystical quality of being in them, you know, once you got past the drills. And then this rich science in this location with, again, the islanders. So it was an extraordinary experience. I would say that one.
Okay. Cynthia?
That's a really hard one for me. I guess I would probably say, just experience-wise, The second assignment that I did for the Geographic was a piece about the Tarahumara Indian people, who are more commonly known here as the distance runners. But the context of the story was that the canyons in which they primarily live in northern Mexico, in the Copper Canyon area, were the subject of enormous and insanely ambitious development plans by the Mexican government and private developers. So in some ways, it was the kind of story that I always joked I would never do for the Geographic because it was such a cliche, indigenous culture threatened by modernity, et cetera. But the experience of finding my way into that community, what I ended up doing was going to a town. Many of the Tarahumara don't speak Spanish. They speak a language called Rarámuri. And I ended up basically moving into a town that I knew had a large indigenous population, but also a lot of mestizo Mexican people in it. And a school teacher let me move in with her. We watched a lot of telenovelas together. It was great. And I got to really become part of the life of this town, which was just hilarious. But within 3 days, of course, everybody knew I was there. And these little kids would come up to me and say, ¿Es usted la señora de la National Geographic? And I'd go, yeah, that's me. How you doing? And I ended up meeting a clinic nurse who was herself, she was a Spanish speaker. She was half Tarahumara and half mestizo because her father had been. She came from this town. Canyon doesn't do justice to it. It was a town that you had to, it was just classic National Geographic. Like if I had made up a story like the one that you told, you had to get somebody to drive you 6 hours through the road that they were actually in the middle of making, and you had to stop because the road ended and walk the rest of the way. And these people, her family, which I persuaded her to take me back to hang out with, lived literally along the side of a cliff in a community that had been cut out there. So we ended up spending all of Semana Santa with her family. The whole experience was just astonishing and eye-opening for me in terms of being brought deeply into a place that I knew nothing about. It was great.
Mm-hmm. Timothy?
I'm afraid I can't answer your question because for the following reason.
You don't want to reveal deep, dark secrets.
No, there aren't any secrets except the one I am about to reveal, and that's only a secret because writers, like everyone else, don't talk a lot about pain, but in the hopes that it might be useful to some starting writers out there, I love the fact that writing is such a pure form. It's not collaborative. There's nobody else to blame if things go wrong. You can accomplish virtually anything on a page, and the fact that you probably won't today is a bitter disappointment that what we live with all the time. And I love the freedom that writing brings, but I hate writing. It's the hardest thing I've experienced. And to me, every article, and not to mention books, is like some traumatic accident from which most of my memory has been erased. I mean, it's wretched. Sometimes I've lived long enough now that I'll be researching a subject on the internet, let's say, and I'll come across a passage and I'll read it and say, well, that seems sensible enough, and then it'll turn out I wrote it. But just to say something, I'll just describe one moment on a story, which was I go up a lot of times to these big telescopes, these big observatories, and nobody looks through big telescopes anymore. They haven't for a long time. And I always like to try, so I'll even bring an eyepiece or two with me because often they don't have any or there's one, but no one knows where it is. And, you know, you sit up all night with astronomers, and on some instruments it's been possible to get a look through them. And in the southern hemisphere, just before dawn, I was able to do this on a large telescope, and we aimed at the Tarantula Nebula, which is a big star-forming cloud. So you're talking about a cloud that's glowing with fluorescence. It's formed stars. Some of them are giants. The giant stars energize the surrounding cloud, and they don't just light it up by their light, but they also pump so much energy in that the atoms in the cloud absorb and re-emit photons, typically at that red light of hydrogen, the primary hydrogen transition that you see so often in astronomical photographs, but which normally you don't see looking through a telescope. A normal telescope will show those things as pewter-colored dim objects, but they're way too dim to normally to see color. Big telescopes are a very different story. And I put the eyepiece in and looked into it, and the Tarantula Nebula is 250,000 light years from Earth. And it was so bright that I reflexively pulled back from it the way you might if a car headlight struck you. It was just a torrent of light. And having pulled back, I could see the beam of light coming out of the eyepiece. Mm. And I looked up, and 40 feet away, you could see the Tarantula Nebula projected on the inside of the dome.
Wow.
So that was a wonderful moment and didn't involve, at the time, any writing.
Well, we've come to that part of our program where we ask the audience if they have questions and what they'd most like to ask the panel. And Bill Grant will be doing that for us.
Well, I have a question. When I was in the 50s reading National Geographic, it was mainly, I remember, about photographers and writers going into these faraway lands, reporting on exotic peoples who maybe had never seen Americans before. But it certainly has changed since then. I wonder if somebody might give an overview of sort of the history of the Geographic. What it emphasized at different periods along its trajectory.
You know, regrettably, I don't think any of us have enough longevity to be able to answer that very well. I can tell you that when you go to the Geographic for the first time, to the actual building in Washington, it's a gas because it looks just like you hope it will. There's like a bathysphere in the lobby, and there are pictures of indigenous people and beautiful photography and so on. I can tell you, I started talking to them about writing for them about 7 years ago. And at that time, they were in the process of what they characterized as a pretty big shift in the way they wanted their writing to be something that stood alongside, not just as a kind of a younger sibling to the photography. For a long time, it really was. The Geographic of most of our childhoods was basically, I don't know about you, but for me, it was gorgeous photographs with some words that were wrapped around them that you sometimes paid attention to, but mostly not. And at that point, they really wanted to turn it so that you had kind of twin projects working simultaneously and do much more intensive storytelling with reporting that was really poured into the writing as well as the photography. And that's the kind of reporting that all of us here most love doing. So I would say that we're all sort of part of the newer generation of National Geographic writers.
Yeah. I think, too, I don't know when it happened exactly, but there's been a shift away from, big shift away from the early days when it was just, you know, bringing back news, exotic news from around the planet, as you were saying. And they're, you know, it's not the edgiest or most controversial publication around by any means, but the editors are clearly committed more to stories of some consequence socially and environmentally, and they take considerable pride in tackling substantial subjects now, and not just doing natural history or exotica or, you know, that.
They had done a big project when I first started talking with them about human trafficking and slavery around the world. And the editors at the time, the text editors in particular, had gotten quite a bit of flack for it from some of the traditional readers who, they told me, said, if I want to read about things like slavery, I'll go to other magazines. This is not what I read my Geographic for. And their reaction was, well, sorry, but this is important in the world. They've been very strong on climate change from the beginning. There's an editor at the Geographic who's basically the climate change editor. There isn't any shilly-shally at the magazine about this issue and its tremendous importance. So there's a very serious tone now of the Earth's problems and the problems of the people on the Earth that are a big part of what the magazine stands for now.
We had one gentleman I know who wants to ask a question.
I'd be very interested to hear a little about your relationship with the magazine and the creative process. I assume you are contract workers, not employees. I'm wondering how many people there are on each project, how long it takes, just what the process is.
I'll take a stab at it. It's unlike any other publication I've worked for in the allocation of human and material resources. Because they're still devoting quite a lot of money to each story, they are very deliberate and stepwise in their development of stories and taking the time to get everyone's input. And I remember the first time we had the final story meeting, which I called in, it was a conference call. I called in from here home in San Francisco, and I think there were 10 people in the room in D.C., including the editor-in-chief, but everybody who was going to be involved in the photo editor, the text editor, illustration person, fact checker, I mean, everybody imaginable who would work. They had all gathered to talk about a story that they were just about to assign that might not run for 2 years. And so they're very deliberate, which at first felt a little frustrating, but then I appreciated the care that went into it because we were going to end up spending a great deal of time and money developing the stories.
Here's my favorite National Geographic fact checker question. Fact checker doesn't begin. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the magazine world, but there, believe it or not, in magazines there is typically a person whose job is to make sure that you're not making stuff up and that you're getting it right. At the Geographic, this is an astonishing piece of research that these people do. And my favorite fact checker question was, that gal that you don't quote in the last paragraph of your Brazil story, who says that she had a sterilization after her first kid because she wasn't interested in having any other kids, that store really doesn't identify itself as a music store. It says it's more of an arts and crafts store. What do you think? I didn't name the store. I didn't name the woman. I'm looking at the phone like, whatever you say, folks. That's amazing, right? So, and somebody else saying this one little town, we really thought about it. We think that there might be a way in the child bride story. We think there might be a way that they could find one of the girls who's indirectly talked about because there is an Arabic edition. And so we think probably we should drop the name of the town. You bet. I've never encountered anything like this any place else I work. Their, just as Ed says, their effort and the amount of thought and care and work they put into every piece is just amazing. I'm sure you find that in particular ways for the astronomy pieces where so much has to be conceived and then made visual, right?
Yes. Science stories have the following dynamic that's sort of interesting, I think. A lot of times when you're writing about science, you're reporting on new developments. And even if they're experimental or observational results, there's often more than one interpretation. And other times it's just a theory, and there's more than one theory. So if you were to write about something highly theoretical, such as the holographic concept of the universe, which is, I think, an important current development in physics, the fact checkers labor under the difficulty that they're sort of obliged to find people from outside this, you know, little community of people that developed the theory or the interpretation. But often those will be people who are virulent in feeling that the reality is very different. And so that produces some rather delicate conversations with fact checkers where you're trying to get at a fact about, you know, things that are a billion light years away and happened long ago and about which we don't yet know very much. And you really appreciate intelligence and professionalism and nuance. And as Cynthia says, we're fortunate in still having quality magazines that take pride in providing just that.
Yeah, I would echo that. It seems to me, because I worked for a number of magazines and periodicals before them, it really feels like almost an entirely different kind of entity. You know, it's not like a magazine as I knew it. I mean, there are other fine magazines and then there's geographic. It's a totally different level of investment and of just person hours. I mean, the commitment is extraordinary. The fact-checking is amazing. And how many passes? I mean, the weeks and weeks of work that they do. Just to give you an example, on the last story that I reported for them, which was about a historical piece on some of the apostles and apostolics, this is a 3,000-word piece, right? 3,500 words maybe. They had no issue, no problem, you know, sending me to India, later to France, and Italy, and later to Egypt, for one story. And I had fixers in three of those locations, and so forth, expenses. That's a lot of time in the field for one piece. Now, mind you, I should point out that although they have these resources, you know, we don't go and stay in these great hotels. I mean, often we're sleeping on the ground, and, you know, so we try not to, you know, abuse the resources that they have. And we live fairly lean in the field. But the fact is they send us. They put us on the planes. They pay for the fixer. They pay for the translator. And they do, bless them, pay us well in comparison, in my experience, to other magazines. They're an amazing organization. So.
Unfortunately, we have reached the end of our program, and I really want to thank all of our panelists, Edwin Dahl, who's been our moderator, and Andrew and Cynthia and Timothy, and the stories you have shared with us tonight. On Assignment with National Geographic is a wonderful topic. I hope you'll all come back again and share with us your stories. I know there are many, many more stories to be told. Tonight, we are very grateful for all of you that joined us in the audience. And just a reminder, if you're not a member, please join. We'd love to see you here more often. I'm Ann Clark, and this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than 110 years of enlightened discussion in the know, is adjourned.